Today's Keisho will be on Case 17 in the Book of Serenity, Phaon's Hair's Breadth. Introduction. A pair of solitary wild geese flap on the ground and fly up high. A couple of mandarin ducks stand alone by the bank of the pond. Leaving aside for the moment the meeting of arrow points, what about when a saw cuts a scale beam? Case. Phaon asked Zuishan, a hair's breadth difference is the distance between heaven and earth. Do you understand? Zuishan said, a hair's breadth difference is the distance between heaven and earth. Phaon said, how can you get it by that way? Zuishan said, I am just thus. What about you? Phaon said, a hair's breadth difference is the distance between heaven and earth. Zuishan thereupon bowed. Verse. When a fly sits on the scale, it tilts. The balance scale of myriad ages shows up on evenness. Pounds, ounces, drams, grains, you see them clearly. But after all, it finally reverts and gives up to my zero point. Today is day 3 of our August Sesshin, and I want to thank everybody for making a very good effort. Some people this morning were struggling with physical difficulties, and I want you to know that you're not alone. Everybody in the Zendo has the similar difficulties, or has had them in the past. We all have physical challenges when we sit. It would be nice to think that after a certain point they go away forever, but I think they just change, you know. So when you start sitting, it's your knees, and later it's your back, and later it's your neck, and later it's this knee, and then it's that knee. The fact is that if you're going to do Zen, you have to be able to sit still, and it's difficult to sit still if you've been doing 8 hours of meditation for 2.5 days. And yet, that's a wonderful opportunity to really disappear on the cushion. We say die on the cushion. You know, I had long struggles with pain myself. You know, we can have all kinds of fancy ideas about reality. But there's a moment when we're in pain, and it cuts through all of our ideas. All of our fancy ideas are gone in the presence of pain, seems to me. And that's the beauty of this, one of the beauties of this method, is that, when it brings you face to face with elemental discomfort, you can't really continue to live in the sort of ordinary mental world. People create a mental world which is built around their own safety and fulfillment. And we do this on so many different levels, and it's only logical that a language-using, symbol-using mammal would create a world, a mental world, in which it can be comfortable. Right? So, I mean, the truth is that you might have noticed this. A lot of academics are left-wing. Maybe if you've been to a university lately, you've noticed that probably you could pretty much guess any of your professors is going to be sort of politically left-wing. And it's predictable because, you know, professors live in a certain kind of world. You know, they're not business people. They don't have, relatively speaking, a lot of money. And they have a sort of, you could say, sort of a lack of control over society. You know? And so, you know, they look with some resentment and a sort of jaundiced eye on the society, which doesn't really listen to professors very much. And I say this, you know, being a professor. You know, so I know, you know, my colleagues get really teed off about the society we live in. And of course, some of what they say is absolutely true, or even a lot of it. But part of it's just they've picked the ideas that suit them well, right? So, I mean, if I'm an English professor, and I notice that everybody loves Bill Gates, you know, it would be easier for me to say, well, you know, those people are fools. They ought to be reading William Blake or Shakespeare. You know, he's the one who really has the answers. See? I mean, it's kind of predictable that an English teacher might think that way. And in many ways, I'm just a typical English teacher, you know. When I was going to graduate school, I was still typing my dissertation on a typewriter. And I had an old Smith Corona typewriter, and the keys used to fall off, and I'd have to take them in and have them welded back on again, because I'd used it so much. And a friend of mine was building a computer. This was in 1977. He built his own computer from a kit. And he was so excited about it, and he showed it to me. And he turned it on, and there was like this little, like a dash, little line blinking on the screen. And he typed his name, Leroy Searle. Yeah? And it was in this kind of hard-to-read print. And I said something like, that's nice. And I remember leaving thinking, what a waste of time. Really. I thought, that, what a, just some gizmo. What a, you know, what a bunch of crap. You know, what a waste of time. Believe it or not, I actually went to a job interview in Albuquerque at Microsoft before it moved to Seattle. I went in for a job interview as a technical writer. And I didn't take the job. You know, they were probably, you know, one of those things. You know, just Microsoft, they'll never amount to anything. That actually happened. So, you know, English professors have a certain view of the world. Now, you know, if you're a businessman, you have a different view of the world, right? And you tend to pick the values that fit you. So, you know, my brother was a businessman. And, you know, he had to have a lot of self-discipline to be successful. And he had to have total faith in the economic system and in its fairness, its correctness. You know, I think at some point my brother just decided, I'm not going to question the value system of the business world. I'm just going to be as successful as I can. And my, you know, I remember there was a day when my brother just started wearing, you know, a white shirt, suit, tie, and he just never looked back, you know. And he would read the Wall Street Journal every morning, you know, and Money Magazine, and he had a briefcase, you know. And he took it seriously. He wanted to be a businessman. And you know, my brother was a Republican. He even when he didn't like a candidate, he'd always vote Republican no matter what. And I'd say, Peter, how can you vote for that guy? And he'd say, oh, I know, but I'm just going to hold my nose and vote Republican. So he always voted Republican, and I always voted Democrat. Well, the point is, we pick our ideas, our mental world, based on what we need to survive and based on our likes and our dislikes. Right? We all do it. We all do it. And, you know, we live in a world of sort of like a designer clothes, designer lifestyle, designer mental world, you know, designer values. We pick the clothes we like, we pick the ideas we like, and it all works for us, right? It all works for us. And, you know, one day we might decide that something's missing in our life, or we might develop a kind of a problem, like a serious problem. Or we might just suddenly realize we're very unhappy, or very, you could say, empty, in a sort of ordinary sense of the word. And then we think, how do I get out of this? How do I get out of this situation? You know. And the truth is, it's very difficult once you've built your world to escape from it. But when you come to Sesshin, it gives you a real wonderful opportunity to see the world with new eyes. You know, and especially when you're sitting there sweating on the cushion, and it's 10 o'clock at night, and you're exhausted, and your legs are killing you, or when it's morning, it's you got up at 4:30 in the morning, you know, and we start sitting at 6 o'clock after sutra. And it's, you know, you're sitting there and your legs are killing you and so on. And it's not the world probably most of us would have chosen in a certain way. You know, if we could say, look, here's how I want to reach enlightenment. You know, I don't want to have to sit in pain. What I want to do is just take a trip to Tibet. You know, I'll buy some tickets. You know, we'll go to Tibet. We'll go see the Lama. We'll go, you know, into the temple, it'll be up on the hill, we'll go see the Lama, and he'll say, look, you want to see Buddha, just say these words, right? Om Mani Padme Om. That's it? That's all? That's it? Great! You know. So, you know, that's probably how I would have picked, you know. I mean, honestly, when I got started in Zen, I seriously thought that somebody was going to, along with my fantasy that the Dalai Lama was going to take me back to Tibet, I seriously thought that, you know, I was going to acquire like magical powers type thing, you know, really. And I really, you know, thought this is just being kept from me until I'm ready and worthy. You know. But my first sesshin cut through all that crap, you know. Because I'm sitting on the cushion and my legs are screaming in pain, and it's like, I don't care about enlightenment. You know, I don't care about the secret mantra. You know, I don't care about Mani Padme Hum. You know, all I want is to just get through the next minute. You know? And that's so refreshing, isn't it? Because that's like cutting through all the crap. Years and years and years and years and years of designer ideas and designer clothes and designer lifestyle. And it's really a wonderful moment, especially because, you know, life really isn't just a fantasy of self-fulfillment. It's also sort of like a troubled dream of disappointments and you know, we try to create our perfect life. We try to create, but it doesn't ever quite work out the way we plan. You know, you go to Tibet, but you get dysentery, you know? And so when you go up to see the Lama, you're not feeling very well. And the big event you expected to happen just doesn't happen. I mean, that's life for a lot of us, isn't it? It's like we go to the vacation in Aruba, and we get robbed, or we get the promotion, but we suddenly realize we liked our old co-workers more, and now we're very unhappy. You know, this is how life really works out. So there's something really wonderful about that pain in your legs. Really wonderful. Because it frees you from all of these illusions, all of these dreams, if you let it. If you let it. Yeah. You need to work with the moment, and it can liberate you. You know, every time you want to move your cushion, or move off your cushion, or move your legs, and you move, you're making it difficult for the pain to help you. And let me just say, I'm not criticizing anybody. If you could have seen me for the first couple of sessions, I was moving quite a bit. I mean, one of the reasons I always say, please feel free to sit in the chair, is because I wish somebody had offered me a chair, you know, because I certainly needed one. So the thing is, we all have pain. And if you have pain, it's nothing to be ashamed of, because everybody in this room has it. But it's okay to move. It's not like a great moral failing. It's not like everybody's looking down on a person who moves. None of that's true. It's a great opportunity to get beyond the prisoner life we've created for ourselves, you know, by pursuing tailor-made reality, you know, as a matter of fact. So, you know, when you're in the pain, it's like elemental life, right? It's just, how am I going to deal with this moment? You know, forget about fame and fortune, forget about bliss, enlightenment. How am I going to deal with this moment? Right? And, you know, in the absence of pain, it would be very difficult for us to liberate ourselves. You know, this is something that is quite obvious if you begin to look around the world of like a quote-unquote New Age lifestyle. In the New Age there are so many things that I think are just self-deluding, you know, like profoundly self-deluding. This is not a criticism of people's intentions. But outside here on the grass, the area over by the on the property here, closer to the graveyard, they've constructed a maze. You know, and you know, for some people that's their spiritual practice, and you know, you could say, well, where do you come off criticizing somebody's spiritual practice? And I'll have to think about that. But you know, if you could really transform yourself by walking around on a maze on the ground, it would be an easy life. Right? That would be really something. But unfortunately, you know, that's really not going to do it for most human beings. You know, unfortunately, we're deeply embedded in illusion. Now, all of us, me. I mean, I started the session by saying I've come to 60-some sesshin in the last 12 years. And I said, part of it's because it's so beautiful, but part of it's because, well, you know, I need to keep cleaning up my mind. And when I clean it up, I feel better, feel happier, and more connected to things. So we all do it. You know, I think human beings really are like an oyster, you know. We're always responding to, well, a better example, take the oyster dog back. Maybe you've seen these birds who build mud nests, swallows, yeah? I think we're like swallows. You know, we build these mud nests to protect ourselves, but eventually we're just looking out through a tiny little hole, you know, that we're just big enough to get through. So you know, nobody likes to talk. When they advertise sesshin or they advertise retreats, they usually show like a Buddha with a candle next to it or a laughing teacher. They never say, come and be in pain, for obvious reasons. But actually, you know, one of the best things is is that moment where you're uncomfortable and your leg hurts and you want to move. And if you move, that's okay, but it's like a missed opportunity. Because if you don't move, and it's not always possible to do this, so I'm not, it's not like you're going to be able to say, okay, I won't move, you know. And then from then on, I never moved. It won't be like that. You know, that's just not how it works. What's going to happen is that, you know, next time you're in pain, you may move, but if you don't move, you have the chance to go deeper into your mind. Every time you don't move and you follow your breath out, or you enter mushin, that empty space, you're freeing yourself from much more than pain. It's like taking yourself back to ground zero, back to the pure moment, right? It's really like saying no to our own dreams, desires, purposes, and expectations, all in every breath. You know? So nobody imagines spiritual pursuit involving pain. But when you're in pain, you know, all your preconceptions say, this is lousy, I don't want to be here. And your cultural conditioning says, whatever you do, don't be in pain. I mean, the modern world says, whatever you do, pain is bad and unnecessary. Right? And also, it's a little bit humiliating to be in pain, isn't it? Because it's so uncontrollable. It's so uncontrollable. I mean, it's something that constantly reminds us that even our bodies are not under our control. You know, so all of those things are humiliating, you know, offensive, frightening, whatever. All those things make pain offensive, humiliating, frightening. But, you know, when you don't move, your mind goes deeper into, goes deeper, 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 deeper toward the source, towards the source of consciousness itself. And if you feel pain and you don't move and you just watch the breath go out, 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 then you do it again, out, 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 out. Then you do it again, out, out, out. You know, little by little, your mind will become more still and empty. This is almost like dropping out of your body. In fact, you may even have the sensation at some point that you're out of your body. And in this state, you'll feel very calm, very quiet, and actually very free. It's a very beautiful state. It's like the eye of a tornado. You know, when you're breathing through your hara, you squeeze the breath out, 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 out. If you do it very hard and forcefully, you may actually intensify your pain. So the best way to deal with pain is just to squeeze the hara slowly and deeply, and then the breath goes out very soft and fine. And when this happens, it'll be easier to, you know, in other words, the most forceful response to pain, most effective response to pain is not the most forceful. It's soft and gentle, becoming very small, make the breath very small. And you'll find that you begin to drop out of your body. This may not happen every time. In fact, it definitely won't. But sooner or later, it will happen, and it will start to happen more and more. And this is like going back to square one. It's like our minds are full of junk, and our bodies are actually full of junk too. Body and mind together have picked up all of these habits, all of these attitudes, all of these likes and dislikes. And when you follow the breath out like this, it's like starting from ground zero. It's like you're taking consciousness back to the pure foundation, the pure root of consciousness. And you're re-entering the world. This is why, even though you can be sitting in a lot of pain, after you stop sitting and you get up, you might go out and you might see the stars, or you might look at the clouds, and they seem so beautiful, so pure and clean. It's because you've been returning the mind to the root, to the source. And this is what Zen is all about. No matter how many years you practice, you're always back to this same elemental state over and over again, where, you know, the moment is not what you want, and then you're stuck with having to deal with that. You know, for beginners, the most striking aspect of Sesshin is just the physical challenge. But for more advanced people, the challenge is often psychological, right? Where you, you know, you're calling moo, and you feel on the cushion like you're getting somewhere, and then you come into Dokusan. And in your mind, it's supposed to go like this, right? You're on the cushion, your mind is blank, you go into Dokusan, you open your mouth, and the universe comes out, right? And you look and, you know, I'm lying flat on the ground, and I get up and go, holy smokes, that's the most amazing moo I've ever heard, you know? Right? Wouldn't that be great? But, you know, you sometimes come in to Dokusan and you say, your voice cracks, you know, or you scream it and it just feels kind of artificial. And it's like, damn, that's not what I wanted to have happen, right? So this is like a little bit comparable to the experience of the beginner with pain in your legs. It's like, this is not the moment I wanted, right? This is not the moment I wanted. This is, you know, this is not the way I wanted my sesshin to go. I was supposed to come into the, you know, once my teacher, Genki Roshi, said he answered 7 koans in 1 sesshin. So that must have been his teacher gave him a koan a day, right? Give it to him in the morning, or give it to him at night, next night, answer, next night, you know. And, you know, I would spend months and even years answering the koan. So that story used to make me very sad. Until I realized, you know, it's going to be what it's going to be, you know. The moment is really beautiful if we let go of our presuppositions. That's all really Zen is about in a certain way. We don't really understand the moment, and the more we let go of our presuppositions, the more the moment reveals itself to us in all its depth and beauty. But just basically, Zen is just about letting go of all of our preconceptions and just being in the moment, with the moment. And this is very hard for all of us, because each moment is never really what we want or what we expect. Even the good ones aren't what we thought. But, you know, if you can get beyond your preconceptions, everything is beautiful. Everything is, maybe beautiful is not the right word, but everything is full of life energy. You know, John, you might know John, who is a member of our Sangha. He has a shaved head and he has tattoos on his arms, like many tattoos. And they're very interesting, actually, the tattoos. But the thing is, he used to practice at the Zen Center of Los Angeles, which is one of the most successful Zen centers in the United States. Maizumi Roshi is now deceased, but he taught there for many years and was very successful. Really, he has many students who are quite creative and all over the country, in New York, in Oregon, you know, you can hardly miss running into one of his students. He was just a very successful teacher. He nurtured a lot of people to awakening. He must have had some special practice, you know. I mean, his way of practicing, his way of being in the world was very conducive to people waking up. nothing mysterious. He probably was just kind and helpful. But the thing, the point I'm interested in right now is that his temple was in a really bad part, was and is, as a matter of fact, in a rather bad part of Los Angeles. John said that they used to do dokusan. There was the room where they did the sitting, the temple proper. And then some doors down, number maybe a block, I've never been there myself, but I guess a block away or something like that, a street away, was like a building that was a sort of like a dormitory for the temple. And John said it was such a tough neighborhood that people would wait for all the Zen students to go to, you know, go out and do their sitting, and then they'd come into the apartment complex and burglarize the place. Isn't that interesting? So people would, you know, and he said, so what they had to do was have somebody who wouldn't go to sit but would keep watch, right? So you have to guard the apartment complex. And I remember reading a story about an account of practicing at the Zen Center in Los Angeles and hearing gunshots, because they have gang violence, you know, hearing gunshots out the window sometimes. And in fact, some of you may know the book, what's it called? Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert Persig. Well, you know, Persig's son was a trainee at the Los Angeles Zen Center. And he was going home one night and was shot and killed. So, you know, very difficult training situation. Busy city in a rundown part of town. People actually risked their physical safety to come to practice. And as John said, you know, they never knew when they went back to their apartment if their stuff would still be there. Now, that kind of situation requires people to make a decision, you know. Am I going to practice Zen or not? And then you have to sort of take the world as you find it. And apparently, a lot of those people were able to do that. You know, they were able to practice in the moment in spite of all the obstacles they had to confront in that kind of training situation. And the interesting thing, as I was saying a little bit earlier, is that Mizumi Roshi was so successful. Somehow I think that difficult situation made it possible for people to go deeper into the source. When we imagine a training situation, we might imagine a beautiful temple, cool weather, you know, far from all concerns, up in the mountains somewhere. And that would be nice, right? And if you win the lottery, let me know. But, you know, Mizumi was able to do some pretty remarkable things in the environment he had to work with. And probably the reason for his success has something to do with that environment. It's like that difficult training situation produced people who were able to go deeply into their true nature, deeply into the source. In a way, perhaps, that a more appropriate training situation wouldn't have done. So this idea of being in the moment is really quite important. We have all kinds of presuppositions about what should be happening. What should be happening. This is how a sesshin should be. This is how my sit should go. Right? And naturally, we want to imagine a painless sit. We want to imagine answering the call. We want to imagine, you know, beautiful weather, no distractions, and so on. But life hands you moments you didn't quite anticipate. Right? And then the challenge for you is, how are you going to deal with this? This is like the most elemental challenge. You can get angry, you can be disappointed, you can be, you can say, oh boy, I never win, you know. You can say, you know, whatever you want to say. Or you can go into emptiness, right? Deep, and use these obstacles to go deeper into what we call emptiness, meaning beyond form. This is the root, the source. Use these problems, these obstacles, these difficulties to go more deeply into emptiness. It's like a bitter taste, you know, but your mind becomes sweet. Master Sheng Yin often says, you know, bitter practice, sweet mind. I just think that's wonderfully true. You know, bitter practice, sweet mind. So actually, probably sweet practice, bitter mind. You know, really, I think that's true. You know, we could get up to, you know, we could try something new. You know, from now on, 7:30. We'll get up by 7:30, breakfast at 8:30, it's an hour of Zazen, Taisho, you know, whatever. What do you think would happen? I mean, I think people would be, I don't think people would go away transformed. I just don't think it would happen. You know, I used to hate getting up early. It used to actually hurt, you know? It was like physically painful for me to get up early. I get up early now, I still don't like it, to tell you the truth. I don't like it. But when I get up, and you know, I get up, it's 4:30, drag my ass out of bed, you know, have to get the tea ready today, and come in and sit down on the cushion. My mind is so clear and bright, and I'm so happy. I mean, I'm so happy. And it's nothing, it's nothing to do with my circumstances in particular. It has to do with just trying to accept the moment. You know, and it's never the moment I want, but it's really much better than what I imagine. So all of this is kind of highfalutin philosophy, right? I mean, if you're sitting there and you're sweating on the cushion and your legs hurt, it's easy for me to say, right? But, you know, my legs hurt too. Have you ever thought about that? And now I can't even find a darn koan. Lost my place. I got up this morning, and my left leg was hurting me, and it's a sore, which is very unusual for me, because as you know, I do a lot of zazen. But it was bothering me, and it's been sore all day. Right now, it's just really like very sore. It's sort of screaming at me. But strangely, my mind is calm and bright. And I'm very happy. So, you know, I can't find the koan, but that's okay. If I can do it, you know, don't imagine when you look at the people in the room that they're not in pain or that it's easy. And whatever you do, don't imagine that I'm sitting over there in the kind of like blissful state and no challenge. You know, actually, I said this once to somebody, and she never came back. She was coming to Sesshin for a while, and I actually said at a Sesshin, my legs are really like on fire. I said to her that in Dokusan. And I think she was astounded. It's like, well, after all those years of practice, your legs still hurt? You know, and I think that was like, I'm out of here, you know. But, you know, last night too, you know, my legs were really tired at the end of a day of sitting. And as I say, right now my left leg is really like, it's bothering me. But strangely, my mind is clear and bright. It's like a bitter practice, sweet mind. And this is a way of life. Doesn't mean you pursue doesn't mean you pursue pain. This is not about pain. This is not like a cult of pain or something like that. It's what we do is we try to harmonize ourselves with the moment, just as it is. See, just as it is. And that creates pain because it's not quite what we wanted. Right? Pain is like very subjective. It's hard for people to believe that. You know, if you're sitting there in pain and your legs are just screaming at you, and I say a lot of this is in your mind, it's like, no way. But actually, much of it's in your mind. Believe it or not, there are these sensations of discomfort. But, you know, they become greatly magnified as we respond to them in a sort of unconstructive or unhelpful way. In the presence of pain, don't move, drop out of your body, and your mind will become clear and bright. Now, if you're working with the move, this is absolutely essential. See, absolutely essential. When you come into the Zendo, I mean, you come into the Dokusan room, and you call move, you know, it's very hard just to call move. We all have a projected outcome. We all have, that vision of the great move. And if you just accept, you know, just be one with that blankness. Be one with that blankness all day, all day. If you're worried about answering the move koan, see, you're not practicing move. If you're getting dissatisfied with the consequences of your practice, you're not practicing. The practice is actually to be so completely absorbed into the moment that there's no space for reflection or distance. So when you find yourself brooding on your performance, realize this is a million miles from practice. You know, the secret to mu is eat, drink, sleep, mu. You know, so all day long, first thing you do when you get up in the morning is you start by saying, and you look at that blankness. And you do this all day long, right? And not only when you're on the cushion, but when you're off the cushion. And if you do this, everything's going to work out. It will, I swear to you. Now, when it happens, I don't know. It might be at this session, it might be at some future session, but don't, as soon as you think, you're not in the moment anymore. So your only objective should be to unify yourself with that blankness, that darkness. And if you do that, all your problems are going to be over, really and truly. You'll have a wonderful time, no matter what happens. So if you make discriminations between what you like and what you dislike, heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. See, that's all there is to it. So how do we not make discriminations? Mushi, empty mind. And when we're in mushi, mind becomes clear and bright, world is suddenly a beautiful place to be, no matter what. So please do this very important work today. This precious time together we have is, who knows how long we'll be alive, who knows what the future holds, but right here and now, you're here in this moment practicing Zen. Anything can happen. If you think about the outcome, you're not practicing. So just be in this moment. Be in this moment.